I was talking with my sister the other day on Skype. She had just returned from a one-month trek across the Caucasus Mountains in Georgia. Because why not? She goes to these film festivals, gets inspired by some far-flung place, and just goes and has to go trek there. Anyways, not my life, that's for sure. And she'd just recently come back, and she's moving in with my parents, who just moved into a new place. So I asked her, what's it like being home? And she looked pensively for a second, and then asked me this question. She said, "Do you remember how Grandma's house used to smell?" And before I could even answer, she said, "Well, Mom and Dad's house smells like that too." And being inquisitive and also enjoying that my parents were also on this call, I said, "Well, what does it smell like?" And she thought for a moment, kind of looking up in the corner, and said, "Mothballs, maybe?" And then paused and finished it off by saying, "Well, maybe that's just how old people smell." Right? I didn't say it, okay? So all age-deprecating comments aside, what was so amazing about that question that she posed, "Do you remember what Grandma's house used to smell like?" was how as soon as she said that, I was transported. I was taken back to when I was a kid sitting at the dining room table in my grandmother's house. I could see the little wooden elephant napkin holder that was mine, the ornate designs on the silverware, the chandelier of crystal that would cast rainbows about the room, which was just so fascinating to me as a child. I could smell the faint scent of compost from the garden and the smell of cedar. I could see those couches in the sitting room, their covers worn, even though I never saw anyone sitting in them. I was awash in memory and feeling. I was at peace. I was feeling joy. I was feeling that feeling of unconditional love and care that I felt every time I went to my grandmother's house. One simple question brought me there. Now, for those of you who study more neurology than I do, it won't be a surprise that I had this sort of reaction from this question about smell. Because smell is one of the most direct senses we have. Diane Ackerman, who wrote A Natural History of the Senses, says, "Of all the senses, smell is the most directly connected with memory, lodging itself largely in the long-term memory systems of the brain. A smell can be overwhelmingly nostalgic because it triggers powerful images and emotions before we have time to edit them. In effect, through its connections, our olfactory system, or smelling, forms kind of a super highway to memories and emotions." Kipling was right, she says. "Smells are surer than sights and sounds to make your heartstrings crack." I'm sure you know the truth of that statement. You're walking in the grocery store, and all of a sudden, you smell that pipe tobacco that your grandfather used to smoke. Or you smell that perfume or cologne or deodorant of your ex, which may bring up a whole other suite of emotions. But there's a way that smells break through our moments, flooding us with emotion and memory, transporting us beyond our conscious ability, our conscious will to stop it. I think that our callings are similar to that. I think our vocations in this world act on us like smells do, that when we recognize them, they bypass all of our conscious control, telling us who we are. But I think talking about vocation and purpose and calling in our society right now is super hard to do. I think it's super hard to do because our society is fixated on great people. The heroes, the saints, the people doing that unimaginably difficult work that us mere mortals could never do. Our society gives us this false notion as vocation as something grand, grandiose, earth-shattering, and probably far from your capacity to even imagine doing, right? Or maybe feeling like we have a purpose or a calling is really only for saints or really talented people, right? Those people that like ooze creative power, they're the ones that get to have purpose. Or maybe having a purpose or feeling like you have a calling is something that only the ultra privileged can have. You know, those people who don't have to work for a living? Those people who don't have to work 9 to 5, take the kids to soccer practice, and then pray that the spouse has made some dinner that's actually edible when we crash land home. Purpose can't be for the rest of us, right? Because it can feel too overwhelming just to get through the day. But I don't think you need to be Jesus or Martin Luther King Jr. or a minister to feel a calling. I think burning bushes are entirely optional in this regard. Like smells, our callings happen to us in the everyday, and if we are able to listen to what they are saying, well, they bypass all of our control and tell us exactly who we are and what we need to do. Frederick Buechner writes, "Every once in a while, life can be very eloquent. You go along from day to day not noticing very much, not seeing or hearing very much, and then all of a sudden, when you least expect it, something catches you off guard, makes you listen whether you want to or not. Something speaks to you out of your own life with such directness that it is as if it calls you by name and forces you to look where you have not had the heart to look before, to hear something that maybe for years you have not had the wit or the courage to hear. That from the everyday moments of our lives breaks forth not a voice from heavens, but a feeling, an inclination, an understanding, a conviction that tells us something about ourselves. Maybe something we don't want to know, but something that is so true that we can't deny it. I think we all have these moments. I think they happen to us all the time if only we would listen to them. And listening is essential when we're talking about questions of vocation and purpose and calling, because the Latin root of vocation is voice. Vocation isn't about doing something grand. It isn't about even what you do in your life. Vocation is about listening to the call that is all around you. "Let your life speak," the Quaker writer Parker Palmer says, was the phrase in his Quaker community he heard all the time. And growing up, he thought this meant, "Let the highest truths and values guide you. Live up to those demanding standards in everything you do. Let your life be a reflection of what goodness and righteousness mean." But I think many of us know the pain of struggling to live up to society's or our parents' or someone else's understandings of what is good and what is right. I think we all know the pain of feeling like the gap between where we are and where we could be just seems to grow larger and larger every day. I think we all know the pain of living our lives and feeling a faint call of another way, of the person that would make us, or the way of being that would make us more alive, more joyful, more ourselves, and feeling like it is so far away we can't even touch it. It's why Parker Palmer says that the deepest vocational question is not what ought I do with my life. It is more elemental. It is more demanding. It is the question, who am I? And what is my nature? It is the question, who am I? And what is my nature? He says, before you tell your life, what you intend to do with it. Listen for what it intends to do with you. Before you tell your life what truths, what values you have decided to live up to, let your life tell you what truths you already embody, what values you already represent, what gifts and giftedness lay dormant in you, if only you would water their seeds. Our lives speak to us in so many ways, through our actions, our reactions, our intuitions, our instincts, our feelings, our bodily states. If we allow our lives to be a text to be reflected on, becoming some sort of auto-anthropologist, pulling on our Margaret Mead hats, all the evidence is laid out in front of us. Both the parts we like and the parts we don't, our whole lives is a text from which we can see what life may be calling us to, which is only and simply ourselves. Life is only calling us to be ourselves. Thomas Merton, that great contemplative writer, says, "Discovering vocation does not mean scrambling towards some prize just beyond my reach, but it is accepting the treasure of true self I already possess. Vocation does not come from a voice out there calling me to something I am not. It comes from a voice in here calling me to be the person I was born to be, to fulfill the original selfhood given to me at birth." And of course, this type of listening, as we all know, is exceedingly annoying to do. Because when we cast our eyes onto our lives in its full honesty, seeing where we are, it's not always easy. It's not always pleasant. And it sure isn't just something we do on an off day. It's also incredibly difficult to do because the ways that we listen to our lives is very different from the ways that we gain information from the rest in the rest of our lives. Because in fact, you can't cross-examine your calling. You can't bring it in with a subpoena and sit it down and say, "Tell me your secrets because I have a timeline." It doesn't work. We have to approach these callings as if they are wild beasts. Something for us to sit silently and allow to approach as if we might scare it away. This is my statement of faith. This is something that I can't prove to any of you. It's something that I know to be true because I know it's true in my life and I've seen it be true in so many else's. It's that we all have callings. The unique imprint of our beings, the ways that passions and experiences dance together to form us and animate us, the way that certain things bring me alive and deaden you, and certain things bring you alive and deaden me, the way we are happified, as Hosea Ballou says, when we contribute in our own way to the forces of good as we try to hold back the tide of violation, that all of us have callings, that all of us have a role to play. And Unitarian Universalism is a faith that reminds us, gently but insistently, that the ordinary is enough. That the everyday nature of our callings is enough. That the grandiose conceptions of great people and their lofty vocations that have transformed the whole world is not the standard that you must or should even live up to. Because I think we have been lied to about the conception of vocation. Because I don't think there's anything grand about it. I think everyone's calling is actually quite simple. I have this friend, her name is Laurel. She's a priest, a feminist activist, she's a church planter, she's an author. She is one of those people that once you meet them, you're like, wow, you're in my saint category now, right? You know those people? You both love and hate them, yeah? Maybe that's just me. When I met Laurel, she was living in the downtown east side of Vancouver. Now, the downtown east side is the poorest postal code in Canada. It is a place where violence and drugs and folks who are living on the street coexist on a daily basis. It is a place that when you go to the local senior center, you can be a member at age 40 because of the life expectancy. of the folks in this community. And of course, Laurel was living there with her partner and their kids in the midst of it all. That blew me away. And just as I has cemented her place in that saint category, her vocation way more lofty than I could ever live up to, her actions speaking of wisdom and power and courage, she said this thing that has stuck with me for years, and I don't know if she says it all the time or it was just some offhand reflection. She says, you know, what I'm really trying to do is figure out how to be a good neighbor. That's it. All of the things in her life were emanating from this central, small orientation to the world of trying to be a good neighbor. I think all of our vocations, all of our callings can't be equated with their ultimate expression, exemplified in heroes of secular saints and martyrs. I think all of our callings and vocations are small, simple ways of being. Here's my example. You know Rachel Carson? The American marine biologist conservationist whose book Silent Spring has been credited by jumpstarting the modern environmental movement. Let me tell you that Rachel Carson's vocation was not to ban DDT. Her vocation was not to be the leader of a mass movement. Her vocation was not to catalyze the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Even though we're so happy she did all of those things. From what I can see of reading of her life, of what she has said about her quest, from her beginnings as a nature writer to her activist days, I think her vocation was to make the truth vivid and real, to tell the stories of creatures that lived under the seas, to tell the stories of the impact of pesticides on the earth, to simply lift up into the light vivid truth. All of the things that changed, all of the things that she catalyzed, all of the things that are credited on her resume were simply what happened after she did that part. I'll give you another example. Martin Luther King, I think his vocation was to plant the seeds of the possible while connecting people to their power to enact it. This has become a little game I've been playing with myself. I find one of those amazing people and I try to distill down their vocation into something very ordinary, something that I could see myself trying to do with my family, at work, in my community. These essential orientations of ways of being that don't need to be grand, but just need to be their specific gift, their specific contribution, their specific truth of who they are and how they enact it and how it becomes the microcosm for the changes that they enact in the world. I think each of our vocations and callings is simply one note that we add into the harmony of life's many choruses. It is a gift that can be magnified to a planetary scale or known only in the most intimate circles. Our vocations can be simple and profound as our inclinations to react with hospitality, to be present to others' pain, to be a good neighbor, to withhold judgment, to speak the truth in love, simple actions that form the base code of who we are. Your giftedness, who you are, your calling in this world, the way you orient and love and act and embody is so unique and so yours and so ordinary. And from it, from that ordinary gift, like those smells that bypass our conscious control and rocket us back to memories and feelings, this thing that is calling you back to your essence, fashioned by who knows what, is not something you can choose or not something you can will to go away. It is a gift. It chooses you. And like one wise man said, the wand chooses the wizard, Mr. Potter. Here's my last caution, though. You will be able to avoid the call of your giftedness your entire life. You will be able to plug your ears, stump your feet, and reject that which is claiming you, claiming your role, your unique contribution. You'll be able to reject it and stop it from being added to the party that is our lives. But the price that that will exact on you, on your life, will be a life on the run from your truest self and will deny the rest of us your true glory. And I don't know if that is a price that any of us can afford. Sometimes it takes a little craziness, Angela Herrera says. When you arrive at the store and can't remember why, and you forget the vet appointment and almost miss the dentist even though they called you yesterday, and the bills are late and your kids need homework help and you're behind at work and haven't exercised in weeks, and you've been eating fast food while vegetables wilt in your fridge, and your garden is turning into compost, and the one time you tried to cook, you left the granola in the toaster oven, setting the whole damn thing on fire. And you double book yourself again, and the laundry forms mountains around your home, and you begin to look askant at your beloved because you can't really remember the last time you had fun together. And then, just as you're starting to wonder about signs of dementia, you find yourself placing a metal spoon in the microwave and turning it on. Just breathe. Sometimes it takes a little craziness to get your attention. The prophet Elijah fled from 100 pursuers. He hunkered down in a cave on the wind-whipped mountainside, trembling like an earthquake and shielding his face from wildfire. He looked for God in the chaos, but when the storm blew over, when the shaking stilled and the flames died down, he crouched, panting, thinking he'd missed it, his heart pounding in his ears. Then he finally noticed that still, small voice. The holy waits for you in the world, too. Maybe today it will find you in a listening posture and will whisper to you, "You tumble like a leaf," it will say, "and yet by some miracle you are still here." Now what is the purpose in that?